Well, hello, everyone. This is Todd Corbin talking to you today. I am really excited. We have a wonderful guest for you to hear about. His name is Pete Kirchmer, and Pete is the director of the MPEAK program out of UC San Diego, and he is in a wonderful city in California, one of my favorite places actually in the world. It's a beach community out there. But MPEAK stands for Mindful Performance Enhancement Awareness and Knowledge. And Pete is a mindfulness coach, among other things. Again, he's the director of that MPEAK program. He's worked with tons of athletes, coaches, professional organizations. He's worked with the Secret Service, so we better be careful. He's also worked with Olympic sports psychologists. He's traveled all over the world. And people come to the MPEAK program from just about every vocation, not just athletes, but high performers, looking to use mindful awareness to enhance their performance, enhance their lives. So I just wanted to welcome Pete and say hello to our audience today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's get into it. You've done a ton of work in mindfulness, but I think it's important for everybody to kind of hear your little bit about your story, about what brought you to mindfulness, and maybe some of the things that you learned early on of what mindfulness in particular, because I know you were an athlete and, you know, growing up, some of the insights you gained and what brought you to that awareness.
Sure. I was definitely not voted to be most likely to be a mindfulness coach in high school, but that's kind of where it all started. I think there's some people that come to this path or vocation because they're just naturally or genetically gifted in presence and compassion, and they just get it. That was not me. I came from the opposite path. I call it my self-inflicted overuse injury. So in high school, I played football. I shot put and discus. I was a competitive power lifter. And I ruptured a disc in my back at age 16. Continued to do all of the same things again after a surgery. You know, I healed pretty quickly. And then blew the same disc out again at age 21. And that time, it partially paralyzed my left leg because my sciatic nerve was cut. And so still to this day, I don't have the major calf muscle. And when you lose a main muscle needed for walking, it has you reevaluate the way you're going about living. So I was recommended to me to do yoga, and this was in 1999. So this is before yoga was cool. And for me, being about 60 to 80 pounds heavier than anyone in class and about 60 years younger and the only male, it was super not cool. But there was something there, connecting breath with movement, observing thoughts and emotions in movement, and then being able to take that, as they say, off the mat and into the world. I started really getting some insight into what was keeping me in this injury cycle, and it had to do with just being wired to be driven. I didn't know how to stop. I wouldn't stop exercising until I was injured. I just overdid everything, and this just kept me in this pattern of re-injuring different parts of my body. And so with this insight, along with working with a life coach at the time and then beginning to take workshops and learning things like meditation, I went through what felt like a transformation at the time and began this journey that I'm still on today, really, still growing, still uncovering. I started to meditate along that path in the early 2000s and really just continued to be inspired by the wisdom available in these practices.
So tell me, you used the word wired to be driven, and that was sort of your downfall, you would say. But, you know, we're talking about a lot of athletes, and athletes are, you know, those that want to compete at a high level, they're wired to be driven. For you, that meant injury and pain. And I think, what is it? You know, obviously that's for you, but so many athletes, they use that word, I want to be driven, that almost like, you know, it's almost like a mental toughness beyond being just mentally tough. It's like you want to plow through everything. So is there something about that might not be ideal for like a top-level athlete?
Yeah. So in the MPEAK course, we talk about your strengths out of balance. And so any strength when overplayed or played out of context can become a weakness, drive included. And so I think of it as a spectrum. We call it balanced effort. And on one end of the spectrum, there is like giving up, quitting, not putting in enough. But on the other end of the spectrum, there is this white-knuckled, teeth-grinding, jaw-clenching effort to force yourself past the point of diminishing return, as they say, all the way towards injury or burnout. And that happens when you're not mindful, right? It's just you've got a hammer and everything's a nail. And so my body gave me ample signals that an injury was occurring, right? I couldn't tie my shoes. I was wincing. I was on ibuprofen all day in high school, right? So my body was signaling something's wrong, but I overrode those signals because the identity I had as a high performer, as an athlete, was so strong that like the fear of losing out on an activity that I love, but also the friend group and all that comes along with being an athlete, like I just wasn't willing to give it up. And I couldn't see it. I didn't even know I was doing it. And that's where mindfulness comes in. With mindfulness, one can really start to feel the body and you get the aha moment of like, hey, maybe I shouldn't do this, or maybe this actually is a level of drive that's hurting my performance, not helping.
So what is it about that? Because you're talking about, you know, having a balance and being able to recognize. So that's the awareness piece, to know, okay, I'm pushing the envelope way too much as an athlete. But, you know, I'm thinking too in my mind about coaches, because a lot of coaches out there, especially when I see like in high schools or even younger than that, or they push their athletes to the bone. So I'm just kind of, this conversation has me thinking about, okay, wow, you know, so maybe it's not only just the athlete that needs to be mindful of that, but the coach or the trainer. So is there a way to, you know, make the coaches more aware? And I know you've worked with teams and coaches too. So kind of give me some like advice, because a lot of people that are listening to this also work with coaches, or they're working with athletes who have coaches and there's sort of a disconnect there. How could mindfulness help that, or help your work with coaching population as well? Does that make sense?
Yeah, coaches can frame this from the perspective of flow, or the state of optimal performance, or being in the zone. And there's a lot of different conditions, both internal and external, that will induce flow states. But one that's well known is referred to as the skill to challenge ratio. And it says that to find flow, we want to be right at the edge of this ratio, where the challenge one's up against is equally proportionate to or just a little bit greater than their skill and their ability, right? And that if the challenge is too much higher than their capacity, they would go into anxiety and overwhelm. And if the challenge is too low, they would go into boredom and apathy or wouldn't progress, right? And so really it's the good coach's job to push each athlete individually based on their own capacity, so that they're right on that growth edge, still pushing hard enough that there's progress, but not so hard that they break.
So what would you, because a lot of the athletes that I've come across, well, maybe, but it seems like they're always complaining about practices being boring and repetitive and sort of that mindset. And I know a lot of that is mindset. But what would you say to that athlete or that coach to help make it closer to that, you know, skill to challenge ratio? Maybe in that sense, it's too easy or it's too difficult, and then they're tuning out, oh gosh, this is too painful. Maybe when they see it as painful, maybe it's too much. But isn't there, you know, that's a fine line, Pete, right? Because you want to challenge the athlete to improve, like a muscle. You got to stretch it, right? So it's got to be a little bit beyond what you can normally reach. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and challenge doesn't always have to mean harder. So three other flow triggers that are from the research are novelty, complexity, and unpredictability. right? So new challenges, complex challenges that require both mind and body at the same time, unpredictability, right? Changing it up so that the coach can keep it fresh. You know, in each sport, of course, will have different drills and practices, and so the coach will have to be creative, you know, in themselves. But that can really help to overcome boredom and apathy and put people back into that flow state. That being said, even novelty is something that can become out of balance, where we're constantly seeking and craving something new rather than just putting in the reps that often are needed, you know, and plateaus are just inevitable parts of training. And so the athlete, too, needs to cultivate patience. Right? And so during these plateaus, when they're not being stretched and there's nothing that seems to be working to stretch them, here's where that patience comes in, or commitment or dedication, being willing to just work with what they've got to the best of their ability until something changes.
So could you give me, just thinking back to your, you know, experiences working with athletes, teams, or even those that have, you know, supported high-level athletes, for instance, like your sports psychology groups that you've talked to and things like that. What specifically have you worked with in terms of trying to manage this skill to change? And as you said, it doesn't have to be, challenge doesn't have to be harder. I really like that, so thank you for sharing that. But what have you worked with them or shown them to say, okay, let's create the newness, but not too much newness, because they do have, certainly you have to be an expert at that skill, and sometimes if it's something is new, you got to do it over and over and over again. I mean, LeBron James, if he wants to do, you know, at a high level, I mean, he does the mental reps, he does the physical reps, he's going to shoot hundreds of shots from the three-point line or the foul line, you know, over and over, and that was, Kobe Bryant was relentless about working through the same shot over and over and over again until he got it perfect and he knew which way his body moved and responded. So, you know, could you talk about, you know, maybe some of the work you've done with helping, you know, in that respect, in whatever sport that is, whatever kind of athlete that is?
So being that I'm not the expert on the different sports themselves, but more really coming in as expert in mindfulness, I trust that the coach's own creativity, you know, is going to inform how they challenge their athletes, like physically or with different drills. That said, there are ways to create a sense of novelty and complexity by just changing the way that we attend to it or the way that we are present to repetitive tasks. So there's something in mindfulness called beginner's mind, which is approaching the familiar as if for the first time. And so, you know, whatever that familiar task is, whether it be the free throws, it's coming into each shot perfectly still, totally present, as if it's the first shot you've ever made. Feeling your feet, feeling the ball on the hands, seeing the visual, focusing in on the target, right, and going through this in this kind of ritualized way can also create a certain sense of novelty, because no two shots are actually ever the same. No two moments could ever actually be the same. And so with that mindset, it has one be able to even do familiar practices in a new and engaged way.
Which is really powerful. So what would you, like for your own sense, you know, when you're trying to create your own beginner's mind, you're doing something new, or you're doing something but you want to have, maybe this is better, so you're doing something which you've done many times before. So how do you personally, or how do you teach a beginner's mind? What are the kinds of things that you're looking to, you know, cultivate that?
Practice and intention. And so when I teach the MP course, we have a six-week follow-up to help participants integrate the practices. And they're all given guided audio recordings of various meditations. The meditation is the time when they're actually building the capacity for greater presence and beginner's mind. They're rewiring the brain in all the right ways so that it's spontaneously or automatically available to them, this kind of presence, when they need it most. The more you meditate, the more likely you are to just show up in this state of presence. That said, that can take a bit. So intention also plays a role. Setting an intention before going to practice and then resetting or re-anchoring into that intention throughout practice, noticing when the mind wanders, noticing when boredom sets in, and then returning attention, kind of opening up again to a fresh moment with clarity and taking the next shot. Keeping that flow and that streak alive as long as someone can, noticing when the mind wanders or again fatigue or boredom sets in, take the deep breath, re-intention, feel the body again, start over, beginner's mind, new moment.
So you're re-anchoring, what you just said, is the breath is really one of the ways to re-anchor, or you had mentioned earlier, like feel your feet, feel the ball. Are those all re-anchoring kinds of activities? I mean, when you're sort of feel yourself sort of slipping out of the moment?
Yes. Ultimately, you can re-anchor into any sense when you notice that the mind has wandered. You can't be in both a mind wandering or kind of rumination mode at the same time as you're like deeply present to your senses. That being said, the body seems to be the most popular. The breath, as I like to say, is it's highly portable. It's always available. It's cost-effective, right? It's just always there for you. And so the breath is a physical sensation, this kind of expanding and relaxing through the torso. And so because the breath is the main object in the style of meditation I teach, it's what we're already conditioning. So it just makes sense to come back to the breath. That being said, any body part works. You know, the feet are often a popular one to just kind of ground into the sense of the feet on the ground. But really any sensation could work. But really you could, you know, anchor your attention if you were a musician into sound, or if you were an artist, you could anchor back into the visual color field of what you're working on. So really any sense will work.
So I'm just curious, like, about your own practice. So for you in particular, you mentioned the breath. So how do you do that? So like my audience will be like, okay, he's talking about the breath. So how could they, you know, maybe we can do a short practice or just, you know, what has worked best for you to re-anchor specifically using the breath or part of the body?
Yeah, so I'll say a little bit about the practice, and if you want me to guide something, we can do that too. But just the mechanics of a practice are actually quite simple. Not easy, but definitely simple. One sits down, just makes themselves comfortable. Okay, they often recommend a posture that embodies alertness, but also this kind of relaxed state. And then immediately begin to feel the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. Right, and this can be at the tip of the nostrils, it can be felt in kind of the rib cage or the stomach. And the instruction is to just hold your attention on the sensations of breathing as long as you can, which we'll humbly find quickly that not long. We can't do it very long.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. As soon as one finds that they're no longer paying attention to the breath, right, this is an interesting moment. It's a moment that spirals a lot of people into judgment. We don't like not doing things right. Everyone loves the idea of mental training, but it's hard to get this practice because it's humbling. And so what I notice is beginners will beat themselves up. I'm not good at this. This is too hard. It's probably not worth it. And so now they're actually thinking more about thinking. Right? So initially they try to breathe. Their mind wanders, and now they're also ruminating about the fact that they can't do it right. And in this moment, my instruction is always to just drop it right there. Don't make it a drama. No big deal. Just begin again. Every moment's a new moment. Pick back up the breath. If you can get three more before the mind wanders again, good news. Then you wander and you come back, get another breath, mind wanders again. bring it back. Maybe you get 5 this time. And what practitioners will find is their ability to stay present will increase over time, but it does require this patience.
That's really the way you put it. I love the way you put it. So thank you. So what I'm thinking too, it's almost like it's like the way you're viewing it, as you know, you're following the breath, and you said drop it. You know, if okay, my mind will wander, drop it, start over again. So it could almost be like a bunch of little mindful moments, the little mindful breaths, sort of in between all these moments when you're out of the moment. And that could lead up to 5 minutes, 30 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 seconds. So that's really pretty exciting, especially for an athlete, I think, because especially for young athletes too, when the attention span is so short sometimes, that is very hard. And even probably for you or I at times, you know, we've been practicing mindfulness for quite a long time, you since you said 99 or the early 2000s. Me a little before that, and I still find myself at times, the mind obviously wanders, but I think for me, that is an amazing thing, just the experience, wow, Todd, your mind wandered, bring it back here. I mean, that's that mindful muscle, and I think sometimes that is more powerful when I recognize that I've drifted and brought it back, as opposed to consciously, okay, let's practice mindful breathing right now, or let's do a body scan, and then just go through the different areas. But it's that mind wandering piece that's where I'm at. So, but the other thing I want you to talk about, which you mentioned, because when people's mind wandered, they judge. They said, "I'm bad at that. Oh my God, this is horrible. I drifted away, and it must be 10 minutes." And my mind's been wandering. So what do you say to those folks, especially, you know, athletes which are so focused on the score or, you know, a time of doing it right? What do you say when they're, like, beating themselves up? How do you get out of that? Even though they can just go back to the moment if they choose, but they're stuck there.
In a group course, it's helpful for people to recognize that it happens to everyone, including me, the instructor, and including you, the instructor, right?
Yeah.
And that it's normal. People often think, like, everyone else is getting it, and I must be the one that's bad at it. And so when everyone shares and kind of reveals that, like, oh, no, that was the same experience for me, I think that can be helpful. I'll also teach people to be entertained by the mind and to be entertained by the process. And if you're willing to be entertained by yourself and hold yourself lightly, you can almost smile in the moment you recognize the mind wandered. Like, ah, check me out. Look, here I am again. Right? And then it's not such a big deal. And then you just bring it back. And the way you bring it back is important, too. I remember early on in meditation, I brought that kind of driven style even into my meditation practice. And I would get this image of, like, yanking my attention back by its ear, shooting thoughts out of the sky, very yang. But there's another metaphor that's given that's probably more appropriate now that I have two dogs, it makes sense, which is training a puppy. It's like you love that puppy, but you don't want it to pee on the floor, but you don't want to get mad at it because it's a puppy. And so you want to be disciplined but also compassionate. And so you can cultivate both of those qualities in the return of the attention to the breath. It's like, yeah, there you go again. Uh-huh, did it. Come on back. Right? But there still is that disciplined effort to, like, yeah, we're going to start again. One more time.
And I think just like everything else, that needs a little bit of practice too, just to kind of get that. You know, I like what you said in terms of using, let's look at it as sort of an entertainment kind of piece and just kind of take yourself a little more lightly. I think we could all use that sometimes. Exactly. So that's really good. I really like the distinction you gave about just like yanking it back versus, you know, puppy. Okay, I totally get that. That's a really good, I think the people listening will really appreciate, especially if they have dogs. I know the group that I have now on the online course has, you know, quite a few dogs, and we see them floating around back and forth as they're online with us. So good. So I want to switch gears just a little bit back to something you said at the very beginning, which kind of drove your path to mindfulness per se. And you talked about being driven and that caused you to be injured and painful. And I do know there is some research, you know, because most athletes will be dealing with pain at some point or another, soreness, you know, just the practicing and the repetitive nature sometimes of what they're doing. But, you know, they're going to get injured. And I've heard, and you know, some of the athletes and myself included, having had, you know, long-time runner, you know, being injured while running or being injured playing baseball, you know, there is a mental sort of, you know, you can get the body physically back, but it's sort of coming back from the mental piece or the emotional piece of recovering from that injury or overcoming that pain. So I was wondering if you can talk just a little bit about, because I know a lot of athletes or a lot of people listening are coping with pain or, you know, even injury. And yeah, you can get the physical side, and sometimes that's easier because that's a little more clear of what to work through. But can you talk a little bit about the mental and emotional recovery from pain or injury?
Sure. So yeah, we'd want to recognize that pain is a complex experience that has a physical component experienced as, you know, throbbing, tingling, burning, pinching, stabbing, all that, right? So there's pain. And then there's the meaning we make of it, or the story we tell about it. And there's a lot of research that shows that the meaning you make of your pain is going to impact your recovery and also your perception of that pain. I'll give an example that will relate to a lot of people. So I was a competitive power lifter, and so I could do really hard squat workouts, so hard that I would wake up and would feel like, you know, it would be difficult maybe for me to walk to the bathroom in the middle of the night, or I'd have to like warm up before I'd walk from one class to the next. But the meaning I made of this pain was, I'm getting stronger. I had a good workout, crushed it, and I feel really proud. It was almost like a badge of honor, my soreness. But if I'd never worked out before and didn't anticipate that pain and just woke up in the middle of the night with my legs feeling that way and had no, like, my mind would think, oh, that's bone cancer. I need to go to the ER. This is great, yeah. Right? So like the way that we interpret the pain matters. We see this too, even in things like fasting. If you're asked to fast for a procedure versus if you're fasting for health or spiritual reasons, people will evaluate the discomfort of not eating far differently. If you choose it and you think it's good for you, then they say, yeah, fasting wasn't that bad. But if it's for a colonoscopy and your doctor's making you, people say it's horrible. Right? Yeah. So there's a lot of research to show this. So the first is to just recognize the difference between pain as a sensation and then the emotion and the thoughts you have about the pain. And then the practice is to see if you can, again, I'll use the word drop it, drop the story around it and actually feel the experience of it. And we do an experiment in MPEAK that I'll happily give away here, which is either having participants dunk their hand in a bucket of ice or hold on to an ice cube in their palm of their hand and squeeze it. And I have them do an experiment twice. The first one I'll say, avoid the pain. Suppress it. Deny it. Don't feel it. Do whatever you need to do. Create a fantasy. Do math problems in your head. Think about, you know, sing song lyrics. Just don't feel your hand. And then the second experiment, I'll say, be totally present. And by this time, we've already practiced several meditations. So I'll say, just meditate. Feel what you're feeling. Allow the pain. Meet it with this compassionate presence. And then let's talk about the difference. And usually what people will say is that it required a lot of effort to try to repress the pain, because the pain's so obvious, and that people are exhausted by trying to think about something else, and they're unsuccessful, that they actually can't avoid it. Or initially they can avoid it, and it works, but then it has what's called a rebound effect, where the pain actually bounces back and feels even greater than it did initially. Where people in the mindfulness hand will say, initially it felt hard to be with. But eventually, I kind of relaxed around it, and it was just interesting in some way. I could feel the cold water dripping down my hand, and the sensations kind of moved from my wrist to my forearm to my fingers, and it went from numb to a little bit tingly, and it wasn't so bad. It was actually kind of interesting. And so there's a way that we can approach pain. And if I would have had this training early on of just allowing myself to feel the pain, I would have been in touch with my body and I would have been open to actually knowing how to care for myself. But instead, I was stuck in the story of who I was as an athlete and what it would mean if I actually admitted that I was injured. And I wasn't willing to let that happen. So I just stayed in this story of like, I am bigger than my pain, which didn't actually serve me.
Yeah. Well, and I can totally attest to what you're saying, Pete, because I went through the MPEAK program and I did that hand dunking experience, and that's exactly what it was like, because I remember trying to suppress, you're like, just distract yourself, just try not to think about it, you know, and that became a lot of work. It was very hard. And then being mindful, it was exactly like you said. Maybe the first 10 seconds were more, I guess you could say, more painful physically. But then it became almost the words you use, like you were entertaining. You were just like kind of looking at things lightly. Ah, okay. Let's look at what's going on here in my hand. Ah, okay. Interesting. My thumb feels it more than my pinky right now. Or, you know, I feel it warmer on the knuckles than on the palm of your hand, or whatever it was. And so that's fantastic. Thank you for bringing it up. I'm looking at our time, and I know we've been going for a while. And you got some, I want you to talk just a little bit about MPEAK, but you have another program that you're putting on called MFLOW. And I want you to make sure to, you know, share that information with my audience. So just, you know, maybe take 2-3 minutes, talk a little bit about MPEAK and MFLOW, and then, you know, maybe we'll give the our audience a little bit more information about that, how they can maybe join the next workshop that you have promoting.
Sure. So I've been kind of creating, directing, and teaching MPEAK as a 3-day intensive with a 6-week virtual follow-up. It's also offered in an 8-week course, and I've been doing that since 2014. I've taught it far over 50 times now, probably 60, 70 times. And it focuses on resilience, focus, and flow. So resilience is being able to be with pain and difficulty, whether that be physical or emotional. It also deals with topics like performance anxiety, inner criticism, perfectionism, all the things that hold high performers back, and all the ways that we, quote, get in our own way. There's also topics covered like flow, which is the full focus of the online course I'll talk about next. But flow is a portion of MPEAK, how to get into the zone, or how to prime yourself for a greater likelihood of getting into the flow state with mindfulness. And we also talk about self-compassion. There's an idea that self-compassion is weak, or culturally we believe that you have to beat yourself up to be competitive or to be motivated. And it's just not true. It's not even what the research suggests. There's all kind of research now coming out of University of Texas, Austin by Kristen Neff, showing that a more compassionate way of motivating yourself is actually better for performance. Now, the word compassion can seem sticky, gooey, and sweet, and it doesn't have to be. Compassion just means being a good friend to yourself, right? And so for everyone listening, they express themselves as a friend very differently. Right, the way that they would talk to a friend, the things they would do for a friend when their friend is hurting, we would then just turn those same kind of inner dialogue or that same action on ourselves. That's what it means. And this shows to be better for performance. And so that, too, is a big part of MPEAK, just because athletes and high performers tend to be so critical with themselves. Given that we're, you know, in a time where internet and online courses now are the norm, I have created two new courses, MFlex and MFlow. MFlex deals with, and that stands for a kind of psychological flexibility. It's more of the stress resilience aspects and how mindfulness can make us more resilient in the face of challenge. M-Flow is more focused on cultivating states of optimal experience and optimal performance. So how to be in flow, not just in high intense moments, but also in everyday life, which means that you're simply in sync with what the moment needs, that we're able to drop all interpretation or all thoughts and stories or even a sense of self. Selflessness is one of the hallmarks of the flow state. People say, like, I disappeared and all of a sudden I was one with the activity, right? Well, this is also something that like meditation monks will say after long retreats. And so there's a lot of similarities between these states of deep meditation achieved by long-term practitioners and the states that people mention in this deep immersion during sports. And so by cultivating the ability to flow with life in everyday moments, we're increasing our likelihood to achieve flow during whatever our performance activities are. So this is a course that feels, it has all the elements of flow for me. It's novel, it's new, this will be the first time I offer it. I'm excited about creating it. The creative process has been quite a bit of flow. These are going to be all new meditations, unique from what I offer in the MPEAK course, all new experiential exercises, and we'll do a little research on it too. So we'll collect some data and we'll be able to see, you know, how this impacts participants' ability to get into the zone. So all of this can be found on my website, www.mpeakcoaching.com, and you'll see both more detailed descriptions of the MPEAK, MFlex, and MFlow courses. I'd also like to offer, you know, anyone listening or anyone in your network a $50 off discount for the upcoming MFlow course. So happy to send that out too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. That's fantastic. So I invite everybody to look at that. Like I had mentioned earlier, I went through the MPEAK program and looking forward to participating. I don't know if both of them will be my focus right away, but you know, they both sound very exciting. And so when are those being offered? Just, I know they can go to your website, but, you know, just give us a sense. When are you starting those off?
So there'll be a free introduction to the MFlow course Thursday, June 4th, and that'll be from 9 to 10 Pacific time. And then the actual six-week online course will be on Thursdays from 9 to 10:30 Pacific time in the morning, and that'll be from June 18th to July 23rd.
Good. Well, thank you. All right. Well, good. So everybody, I will get information out to you in a written form. Also, if you want to sign up for those programs, a link to Pete's website, so you'll have all that information. And I just wanted to thank to Pete Kirchmer that this has been a terrific conversation. And thank you so much for, you know, offering your wisdom and your experience and talking a little bit about yourself, certainly some of the challenges you faced in your life. But Pete is a really amazing mindfulness coach and practitioner. And so I just invite you to look more for what he's offering. Like I said, we'll get information out to everyone there about Pete. All right, so that's all I have for everyone today. I know the interview went a little bit longer than we anticipated, but that's just because there was so much wonderful insight and wisdom that we were able to glean from Pete's experiences. So, Pete, thank you so much. One quick thought you want to leave the audience with before we say goodbye.
Actually, more of a, just an acknowledgement of what you're doing. I checked out your website before this, and I just really appreciate what you're up to and the difference you're making in the world. So thank you for the opportunity to connect.
Wow. Well, thank you, Pete. It's been a pleasure, and we'll reconvene another time very soon.
All right. Bye for now.
All right. Be well.